say your name, just in case I get drop this on the way out somewhere, but this, that would never happen. If you need to pause it, just press the record, and that will pause it. All right, well let's... I don't know if you had a preference to start talking about one thing. Well, informed consent is just is very important. I teach research methods. I teach social welfare, and that's one of the reasons that got me into this. But yeah, I really stress it with students, and I think it's really important. You don't want to, even if it's innocuous, you don't want people's information left out there. So did you actually? I had found this online. This is a press release.
I have no clue what that is.
You have no clue what that is. All right, but
I sent it around to a. I was in this area. I was a director of temporary assistance at the time.
Okay.
And so that would have been me.
Mm-hmm.
And when you send that to me, I send it to Steve Seifert. Steve Seifert.
Okay.
Who is now the director of temporary assistance.
Okay.
And I worked together at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I asked him if he had any recollection of what this was and if it was the old CAP program, Child Assistance Program. Mm-hmm. He said, this doesn't ring a bell at all.
Okay, all right.
So I don't know what that's referring
it's
to.
Well, apparently Onondaga County was praised by Donna Shalala and Mary Jo Bain, who I happen to know, you know, kind of, I guess, big names nationally in that. But could you tell me about the 1996 reform? It happened earlier here?
We started Welfare to Work activities in 1994.
Mm-hmm.
I was the director of temporary assistance at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And
which was AFDC.
Yes.
Okay.
In New York State, there are two cash assistance programs. The old names were ADC or AFDC, same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And Home Relief.
Which is general assistance.
Yes, general assistance. So AFDC was the federal program to provide cash assistance to poor families, and home relief was the cash assistance program for single adults, childless couples. Mm-hmm. It's a New York State program, it's not federal. Subsequent to the 1996 legislation, AFDC is now TANF or Family Assistance in New York State. Home Relief is Safety Net.
Gotcha. But this was before the 1996 reform, right? So you were ahead of the curve? How did that happen?
I became director of temporary assistance in 1990. I had been in social services since 88. I was director of adult services. And in 90 or 91, the director of temporary assistance retired, and Commissioner Stone at the time asked me to head that up too.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually spent the first year or so on internal operational issues.
Mm-hmm.
And it was actually kind of funny because I was extremely unhappy doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't figure out why. And eventually it dawned on me that the reason I was unhappy in this, with this responsibility, was that I didn't believe in what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
It felt like the proverbial rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic.
Mm-hmm.
We were trying to make the ship go straight, but I didn't believe in this direction.
Mm.
It was institutionalizing poverty.
Mm-hmm.
We were all about determining eligibility, crossing T's, dotting I's.
Mm-hmm.
We were spending so little time and resources helping people get jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if the way you allocate resources is a reflection of your priorities, that was clearly the point. We probably had 200 staff at the time, and 8 were assigned to employment activities.
Mm-hmm.
The vast majority were assigned to initial determination of eligibility and then case maintenance. Continuation of benefits. So, you know, that was characteristic of the state and the entire national welfare system. There was so little attention placed on employment. And that really was, I mean, that wasn't an oversight. That was based on the philosophy of welfare at the time. And it was kind of the definition of poverty. Why were people poor? I mean, it really starts from a simple question. Why are people poor?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the organizational answer flows from that.
Mm-hmm.
And the belief was that that the whole system was based on, the belief was that people were poor because of situations outside their control. People were poor because of structural imbalances. Excuse me for, you know, waxing lyrical on this, but people were poor because of structural imbalances in a capitalist economy. People were poor because of racism, sexism in our society. People were poor because they were loss of spouse, loss of job. It was something very situational. And I don't think that held true. It overlooked the fact that there was a generational aspect to poverty in many instances. It overlooked the fact that at any given point in time, in Syracuse, there were hundreds of jobs available for people that people just weren't accessing. So it really started for us when, and this is kind of the whole thing about, you know, innovation and how does it happen. I tend not to be a huge fan of committees, that process. And ideas can happen, innovative ideas can happen in any way, shape, or form. They can happen through a formal planning process. They can occur when need drives it, when opportunity drives it. A chance comment can drive innovation. Mm-hmm. And in this instance, what happened was in 1994, the state of New York had decided that the state system was misguided, and it wanted to do something. But the state was saying, we can't do it ourselves. We're hidebound, we're tied to regulations. Innovation has to occur at the local level. So a conference was held, and I remember quite clearly, the keynote speaker was David Elwood Ellman, who was a undersecretary of HHS in the Clinton administration. And he said to this group of welfare officials and employment officials across the state, he said, you're all working really hard. There's only one problem. You're all doing the wrong thing. He said, you're all focusing on eligibility, crossing, you know, T's, dotting I's. You're not paying attention to employment. And I remember thinking at the time, this is a cheap shot because we're following state and federal rules, but he's absolutely right. And coming back in the car, I had gone with a couple of people. We started talking about this, and we were just doing what-if scenarios. And we, from Albany to Syracuse, we had done enough what-if scenarios that we pretty much had a game plan on how we wanted to proceed with increasing our focus on employment. And we came back, worked out the details, and then brought it to the county executive's attention, who was very, very supportive. County Executive Pirro, who was very supportive, endorsed it. And we ended up developing the whole, now it's called Jobs Plus organization, which now employs about 100 staff focused exclusively on unemployment and helping individuals with medical issues deal with those so that they can pursue employment. Just very much strengthening that piece, and then, you know, developing all the operational procedures around that. So it really just kind of came from that, you know, kind of a general unease about the direction of the system, solidified by a comment that was made by, it was kind of a, you know, provocative throwaway comment made by a federal official. And then, you know, a couple of us figured it out.
So what kinds of people were you riding with in the car?
They don't care if I mention the names, Pat Higgins and Annette Kresak. Pat was the Pat was at OCC, and she was the head of the PACE program, which was a small kind of welfare to work program for individuals receiving cash assistance who were at OCC getting a 2-year degree. And Annette worked with Pat.
Well, that's interesting.
So, you know, and there's a ton of... We do what-if scenarios all the time. you know, one of the things that we kind of pride ourselves about is on a regular basis trying to look at all of our operations with no real assumptions. It's kind of doing like an environmental scan. Mm-hmm. It's like, where are we in relation to our community? Mm-hmm. Are we meeting community needs? What do we see happening out there? How relevant are we? And, you know, just asking ourselves tough questions on a regular basis about how we're situated, how we're operating, you know, doing the job as we currently define it, and should there be other things that we're doing? Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. These aren't formal planning processes. These are, you know, it can either be the director of the division of the mm-hmm. operational area mm-hmm. and I kicking around ideas. Mm-hmm. You know, a small group of us.
You just have it at formal meetings or yeah. lunch at formal. Yeah. So do you have routine meetings.
Yeah.
Or,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I meet with. We do this once a month.
Okay.
It's all about follow up. It's mm-hmm. more than developing strategic plans. It's all about
mm-hmm.
follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody can develop a strategic plan.
Okay. And what is the key to follow-up?
No, honestly, there's nothing magical about this. It's mm-hmm. nose to the mm-hmm. grindstone.
Mm-hmm.
It's if you have an idea, mm-hmm. there's probably a zillion detailed, sometimes painful steps that need to happen. Mm-hmm. To make this, to really flesh out the idea and mm-hmm. bring it to fruition.
Mm-hmm.
And you just got to use due diligence to move it along. And mm-hmm. there can be a zillion obstacles, mm-hmm. you know, from staff culture to technological issues to regulatory issues, interfaces with other divisions that might not see it mm-hmm. within mm-hmm. social services, that might not see it the same way, that might have other concerns,
mm-hmm.
You know, they touch the problem in a little different way.
Mm-hmm.
It might be a community agency. So it's trying to massage all those relationships and interfaces. And that can be, I mean, that's sometimes is a real, real challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of ideas are good ideas on paper, mm-hmm. but then all the necessary follow-up and all the interfaces that are necessary to, you know, to you know, clarify and work out, just they aren't done mm-hmm. until the idea mm-hmm. just is dropped.
So you are you saying that there are a whole bunch of ideas that you would have at these monthly meetings, but not all of them get pursued? You
sure.
don't follow all to
some don't work.
What led to this one being pursued and being brought through to fruition?
We thought it was the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
We thought it was the right social. We thought it was the right social policy.
Mm-hmm.
And we figured out how to do it structurally, so that this is something that could be paid for. You know, we could develop the staff mm-hmm. Cadre that would be necessary. We realized in this particular instance that we could not do this on the cheap.
Mm-hmm.
That if we were going to pay attention to employment, you know, we were, you know, working at 100% just doing eligibility.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't take staff that are currently involved in that operation and just move them. What we needed to do was add resources. And we figured out a way to add resources
mm-hmm.
and then use existing regulations in order to use those resources effectively.
How did you do that? How did you find resources? That's a big issue. How did you? Where did you find resources? To pay for that.
You know, it was kind of like just one of those aha moments. We're playing the what ifs.
Mm-hmm.
The PACE program that I mm-hmm. just referenced
mm-hmm.
was funded a certain way,
mm-hmm.
and you know, to make a long story short, it used a certain formula that is specific to institutions of higher education.
Mm-hmm.
I think there were like four staff attached to this.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, wait a second, if this model, if this funding model is acceptable,
mm-hmm.
why can't we expand it? If it works for four, why can't it work for 40
mm-hmm.
or for 100? And mm-hmm. so we did our research. So, you know, we thought about it in the car,
mm-hmm.
went back, did our research, and said, yeah, it works. Mm-hmm. There's no cap on this. Mm-hmm. So it's just expanding this principle mm-hmm. in such a way as to make this program meaningful.
And what is the funding principle? How does that work?
In this particular case, local universities can use indirect matches. There's a local match requirement, which mm-hmm. is always a difficult issue. Mm-hmm. Institutions of higher education there's a formula where they can use indirect costs as a local match. I think I'm saying that correctly.
Indirect costs. Mm-hmm. I think I understand, but can you fill that out a little bit more? Indirect.
There's this federal formula mm-hmm. that allows, mm-hmm. Institutions of higher education mm-hmm. like SU or Lemoyne or mm-hmm. OCC to use this indirect. It's not in kind. It's indirect costs, mm-hmm. which are costs that the university incurs for supporting different initiatives.
Is that like overhead?
Like that, yeah.
Okay. Okay. And that is used as indirect cost, and
we could use that to draw down the federal and state aid.
Okay, so if the institution spends, just to put it concrete, spends $1,000.
I can draw down $2,000 federal and state aid.
And that can be used for the job to hire employees.
Yes.
And so okay, so what was the indirect cost that allowed you to go from 4 employees to you said 100? You had to find the resources, right? What was that?
The indirect costs were there.
Uh-huh.
At OCC.
Okay, they were already there.
They're already there.
So and so these are things like you just have to figure out what exactly qualified as
yeah.
indirect costs.
Yeah.
And they're building
yeah.
office space. Yeah. Personnel? I don't want to push anything. I just want to understand.
I'm just not, mm-hmm. That's stuff that the accounting people.
Minutia.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
But
mm-hmm.
once we discovered mm-hmm. that OCC had mm-hmm. the capacity to do this,
mm-hmm.
we could use that to leverage the federal and state resources needed
uh-huh.
to develop this project, to develop this initiative.
Great. So was it Debbie Seidel that was... Did you have to get the president of OCC?
You know what? I think it was Bruce Leslie. No. You know what? I can't remember.
It was not Dr.
Seidel.
Okay. But you could... but they were open to it as well?
OCC was very supportive.
So right away, everybody... You just pitched the idea to people and they liked it?
Yeah.
Really? All right. That's very fascinating.
I don't think everybody in the community liked it.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of folks who thought that this was harsh.
The job training?
Because it wasn't just, this was not optional training. It was our expectation that mm-hmm. able-bodied recipients would participate
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
in these programs.
Mm-hmm.
Where, before, with a staff of 8, mm-hmm. our administration, our oversight of this was checkered.
Mm-hmm.
Now we had much more ability to really engage people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And not everyone was ready for that.
Right.
And some of what we were doing was, again, our belief was that poverty was more complex than just situational poverty.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But by moving in this other direction, we were challenging... we were challenging that belief.
Mm-hmm. Right. As far as resistance, was it caseworkers or other agencies or clients? Who was sort of
in various degrees. Some were very, very mm-hmm. supportive, but
uh-huh.
There were individuals who very much disagreed with
uh-huh.
with this.
So was that part? Was there like a Winning Hearts and Minds campaign or something?
Oh, we went out all the time and explained what we were doing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that eventually got enough support.
Yeah. Yeah. And, the program has changed over
mm-hmm.
time.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the focus initially was on, again, this is kind of, where innovation
mm-hmm.
comes in. Having an idea, 10 years ago, you keep on working the problem and saying, is our solution today still relevant?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, at first, you know, we said that employment was going to be the centerpiece of our system, and the focus really was on employment. Over time, employment still is the centerpiece of our system, but it's much more than that. It's really about getting kids out of poverty, getting, you know, kids and families out of poverty. You know, the reality is that given the skill set that many individuals have, many individuals who are on temporary assistance, cash assistance have, mm-hmm. it's only like 20% mm-hmm. have a high school have completed 12 years of high school. Mm-hmm. The skill set isn't great. And so if someone does take, you know, something along the lines of an entry-level job, mm-hmm. you know, where they're making, you know, $7.50 to $10 an hour, you know, is that going to be enough mm-hmm. to get them and their family out of poverty? Mm-hmm. And if the answer is no, well, you know, fairness, in our mind, you know, equity determines, you know, dictates that we really have to step up and ensure that families have access to other ongoing supports to get out of poverty. If they're doing all they can, if they're doing mm-hmm. the right thing, I think we owe it to them. I mm-hmm. think society owes it to them to support them and get their kids out of poverty. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've changed our program so much over the, you know, since we started. Mm-hmm. You know, initially it was just employment. Now we do a very, very good job ensuring that people who are welfare leavers mm-hmm. have access to ongoing food stamps, ongoing Medicaid, child care. We have staff, our own staff in Jobs Plus helps with tax preparation every spring to ensure that people have apply for all the earned income tax credits. You know, either they're earning all the tax credits available, either earned income or daycare, child care mm-hmm. Tax credits. We have a real strong interface with child support. So, you know, it's all of that stuff mm-hmm. that really has we think, been very, very helpful and, you know, really kind of complete our mission of ensuring that people, families who are doing the right thing mm-hmm. for themselves and their mm-hmm. kids, mm-hmm. you know, really they're making a material gain and really raising mm-hmm. their kids out of poverty. Interestingly enough, in this data comes from the state. You know, every once in a while, you know, someone will say something about the poverty rate, and you know that's a legitimate, you know, by using the federal poverty index, okay. and that's legitimate. But it's more than that, because the federal poverty index generally only looks at earned income. It doesn't look at all the ongoing public support that might be paid mm-hmm. into a household. Mm-hmm. If you include that, the poverty, you know, the snapshot on poverty looks very different. Mm-hmm. In 1995, I think it is, and I can give you the date if you want, the poverty rate in New York State was 26%. Child poverty rate was 26%.
Wow.
If you look at the alternative poverty rate, mm-hmm. which
after
is
public support.
Yep. In 2005, it was 14%.
Okay. Wow, that's a big...
Yeah. I mean, if you would say any federal initiative mm-hmm. could cut the poverty rate in half mm-hmm. in 10 years, mm-hmm. so that's...
Wow.
That's pretty amazing.
Is that rate in 1995 with the existing supports at that time?
No, that's the official poverty rate.
Official.
Yeah, I've got the information right here.
Sure.
You can borrow the book and look it over.
Okay. You know, I had some interesting...
Can I just say one of
things? Yeah, yeah.
You know, one of the things about food stamps, we've made such a strong emphasis mm-hmm. on these ongoing supports. And, I mean, this is kind of the idea about innovation. Mm-hmm. The food bank mm-hmm. Annually develops they do a hunger survey. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's released to the press, and one of the local reporters, actually was Frank Briety, who was covering the kind of not-for-profit beat, got the report, and he wanted to sit down and talk about food stamps mm-hmm. and how we saw the issue. You know, and Frank was meeting with Steve Seifertz and me, and, you know, he was asking, you know, asking about what we're doing and what else we could do and, you know, our penetration rate, you know, mm-hmm. the percent of individuals in the community who could qualify but don't receive food stamps. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Frank was really got Steve and I thinking. And after Frank left, Steve and I just, you know, just sat back and kept the conversation going. And we said, you know, Frank is really making a good point here. And we one of the things that we were talking about was that our application, we have a, the state has a, it's called a unified, I think it's called a unified application, which is a one application for all the benefit programs. And that makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea being if you want to apply for a benefit, rather than mm-hmm. the onus being on you to figure out, geez, am I going to apply for Medicaid or food stamps or mm-hmm. temporary assistance or whatever, mm-hmm. fill out the application and the onus is on the system to figure it out. Mm-hmm. It makes perfect mm-hmm. sense. Mm-hmm. The drawback is that application then has questions to cover the informational or eligibility needs of all the programs. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So any individual program might only use mm-hmm. a small portion of mm-hmm, that information. Mm-hmm. But if I'm giving you a 20-page application uh-huh. and saying, fill it out,
right.
you might be looking and saying, oh, yikes, I don't want to do this. This mm-hmm, is just mm-hmm. a pain in the neck. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we took one of the applications, highlighted all the questions that we actually use for food stamps, mm-hmm. and it was like a third, not even. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So Steve and I said, you know what, if we really want, if there are individuals out there who are either welfare leavers mm-hmm. or people like the elderly on fixed mm-hmm. incomes, mm-hmm. Who only want to apply for food stamps, mm-hmm. how can we make it as easy as possible? Mm-hmm. And so we took that general application, redesigned it to focus on only those things that pertain to food stamps. And then we went to the state and said, will you approve this? Can we try this? Mm-hmm. We're not going to do away with the general application. That's mm-hmm. still going to be our flagship. That's mm-hmm. what everyone mm-hmm. can mm-hmm. you know, apply for. But if someone only wants to apply for food stamps, mm-hmm. can we use this instead? Mm-hmm. And the state said, great, we love it. They let us do it, and now it's a state model.
Oh,
mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, like, when the food bank goes out mm-hmm. and, you know, they go to different senior centers or mm-hmm. different programs and talk about, you know, talking with the population that mm-hmm. most likely has income, mm-hmm. and so they probably wouldn't qualify for cash mm-hmm. assistance, mm-hmm. but they might for food stamps mm-hmm. because the income threshold is a lot higher. Mm-hmm. You know, they give them this application, right. mm-hmm. and it's a three-pager. It's really, mm-hmm. you know, one page of questions and mm-hmm. then kind of writes, mm-hmm. you know, a page of narrative.
Versus, you said it was like 20 or something.
For oh, I'll give it to you.
Yeah. Huh, very, very, very interesting.
But it's that yeah. kind of stuff. Yeah. You know, it wasn't yeah. a formal committee. Yeah. It was just Steve and me. Just mm-hmm. It was really kind of Steve doing
mm-hmm.
this.
Mm-hmm. Just discussing it, chatting over it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I had let me follow up on something earlier. You said you went to David Elwood, right, from Health and Human Services, or some it doesn't matter what
Elmer
exactly
Elwood.
His name. Elmer, right? What type of event was that?
Oh, a conference.
So this was an annual type of conference.
The state brought it together to talk exclusively about welfare to work.
Okay, so the state was allowing, were they encouraging experimentation?
This was like the last year or last years of the Cuomo administration. Right. And the new commissioner was Michael Dowling. And the state, by this, you know, the national and state discussion on welfare mm-hmm. really was beginning to change.
Mm-hmm.
It was more and more the focus was on this thing is really broken.
Mm-hmm.
How do we fix it?
Mm-hmm.
And so the point of this discussion was Commissioner Dowling bringing all the counties in the state together and really pushing us to innovate, basically opening the door and saying, this is the direction we need to head, you know, to head in. But we at the state can't do it ourselves.
They couldn't come up with programs and say, do this.
Right.
because what?
You know, I think they felt very bounded by the legislative and regulatory context.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't feel that the political climate was right, where they where you know their influence really is in regulation, legislation,
mm-hmm.
and funding.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't feel that the political climate was right across the state to seriously change mm-hmm. state legislation and regulations.
Mm-hmm.
But they thought there were opportunities within the existing regulations that counties could pursue. And so they were very much encouraging counties mm-hmm. to use those opportunities.
Great. So then when you're brainstorming this idea, you know, it seemed to resonate with what you were thinking anyway.
Yeah.
About the, and so did they provide ideas, examples of what might be done? Or how did you, when you actually were driving home and thinking about making this concrete, where did you get the ideas of what it might look like? How, you know?
I'm sure that we kind of started at the broad brush.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
just the, you know, this is the overall context. Mm-hmm. You know, the overall principle of, you know, work being the centerpiece, that mm-hmm. we should really work to engage everyone,
mm-hmm.
that the expectation would be there that every individual, every able-bodied individual should participate in some kind of work preparation program, either work, participate in a work preparation program, or if, you know, there is some disabling medical condition,
mm-hmm.
you know, to address that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what that looked like, you know, then we went back mm-hmm. and started sitting down with, you know, the administrative team, staff,
mm-hmm.
and talking about specifics and what this might mm-hmm. look like.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, that's where we really brought in, you know, staff, you know, very significantly mm-hmm. to talk about, you know, what this means in terms of daily operations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, kind of going back to the earlier point, you know, a broad idea, recommendation, you know, it's just a starting point.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
it's just a ton of hard work
yeah.
has to be done to figure out, all right, what does mm-hmm. this mean to the worker mm-hmm. on the line,
mm-hmm.
and how do they, you know, how do they address this?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because in point of fact, I mean, all the pressure on the worker, on the, like an eligibility worker, you know, the cases are coming to them all the time. Get the cases off their desk. Make a decision, get the case off
mm-hmm.
their desk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the last thing they, you know, they really want is to hold on to a case for any more, for a longer period of time.
Mm-hmm.
So that the person can, you know, either engage in job search or, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm. So you have to figure out how to...
How to do that. You know, if you talk about mm-hmm. what's job search, what does that mean? Does that mm-hmm. mean any job?
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean jobs that are hiring?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, does it make any sense to say go on and apply for jobs when the person goes to, you know, the parking garage, the bagel shop,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, places that hire two people or
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
have a staff
mm-hmm.
of two and don't hire.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, is that a legitimate job
yeah.
search? So
mm-hmm.
you got to figure out all the
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
nitty gritty stuff.
Were there other commissioners of other counties that you could sort of network with and say, what are you doing? Were other people doing this at the
oh,
same
yeah.
time?
Yeah, I think we were a little bit mm-hmm. ahead of the curve.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we talk with, you know, other, our counterparts all the time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And, how did, there seems to be, I did a little sort of looking into this, it seems to be sort of common language, like the term job search, or applicant job search, right? That's used now throughout the nation.
Yeah. Yeah.
How did that that process happen where you were doing innovative local stuff, and then how did it become sort of nationalized? I mean, and I'm sort of wondering, you had to get sort of a waiver to, did you have to get a waiver in this
no.
county to do it? You just sort of went ahead and did it.
Yeah, everything was, you know, a waiver means that the, you know, in the legislative process,
mm-hmm.
you know, the legislature passes legislation,
mm-hmm.
and then the executive department develops regulations. So
mm-hmm.
they interpret what that legislation means.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, our job is to follow those regulations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, initially we were just operating under the context of the, and a waiver means you're getting permission from the executive department mm-hmm. not to follow the regulations. You got to follow the law. Mm-hmm. You got to follow the legislation, but not the regulations.
Okay, and that would be the state executive.
Yeah.
And they gave you that.
We didn't need it.
You didn't need it. So, okay. So this really makes no sense, huh?
I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, because I was like, well, Onondaga County, but
I don't know what it is.
I wonder if maybe this was something between the state and the federal government.
That never got implemented.
So you don't even think this is something they needed to do, because AFDC was a federal program that was administered through states and in New York State by each county,
yes.
Right? So this was... I was thinking maybe this could be something that the state had to take care of with the federal government. They didn't really tell counties about it, but in order to grant, you know, to give you permission to not follow the regulations. Does that make sense?
That's my guess is that the state was talking with the feds about this.
Uh-huh.
Got some sort of waiver from the federal government mm-hmm. to do something like this, but it never got off the ground.
Okay.
I don't even remember discussions on that.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So Onondaga County. Would you call it a demonstration program?
No.
No. So it was just a change in policy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And now I noticed that the county. I saw something with. I think it was Higgins, right? Higgins.
Mm-hmm.
She had wrote up something as with this county being sort of a model for others to follow. It was in a book, an education. Centered book on community colleges. I was doing research mm-hmm. on community colleges. Are you sort of familiar with that, or other people looking at Onondaga County as an example?
We've done a lot of. There have been a lot of visitors to our operation.
Mm-hmm. From where and who? Like,
across the state, uh-huh. Other states have contacted us.
Mm-hmm. And why? What was their interest in?
Just how it all worked. I mean, mm-hmm. it was just. You know, no one uses a community college. Using a community college is just really unique.
Oh, so it was very unique to partner with.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, uh-huh.
And just the way we were set up. And mm-hmm. The one thing, don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. if you look at our program, mm-hmm. There are expectations. And, sometimes the expectations cause a certain degree of conflict with someone who, either they don't see the world the same way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They don't see the expectations and responsibilities the same way.
Mm-hmm.
But we try to approach this real positively.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
From the design of the space, which was, we try to make it as respectful as possible.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little, they don't have like a daycare center attached, but they have like a little corner that the staff painted with animal figures, mm-hmm. and they have books there, and
mm-hmm.
They have a clothes closet,
mm-hmm.
so that if and people donate clothes to them all the time, so that if someone
in paper. Yeah.
Is going on a job interview and they don't have appropriate clothing,
mm-hmm.
We give them clothes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we try to approach this not just from a here are the expectations,
mm-hmm.
Kind of that punitive model,
mm-hmm.
of, you're going to work, and comply with requirements. But this is a real opportunity. We have expectations,
mm-hmm.
but if you work with us, some really nice things will happen
mm-hmm.
down the road.
Mm-hmm.
And we're kind of proud of that.
Mm-hmm.
So we tried to be a lot more positive than I think mm-hmm. some other jurisdictions approached it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think any other jurisdictions have sort of copied or adapted things you do here?
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. Sure.
Do you know of any? Or
no, I mean, I know that a lot of people have visited us.
Mm-hmm.
I still get comments from, mm-hmm. Different commissioners, what a great program Jobs Plus is. But,
mm-hmm.
I'm not that vain that I would ask.
They probably wouldn't say that. Right. By the same extent, did people from here or Jobs Plus visit other counties?
Sure.
And so a lot of visiting.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Part of innovation. I mm-hmm. mean, there's
mm-hmm.
there is no point
mm-hmm.
trying to come up with every idea oneself.
Mm-hmm.
You steal as much as you can.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is not proprietary information.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We're not in the private sector. These aren't industrial secrets.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So I'm happy to share whatever learnings we have, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. I'm happier to take whatever mm-hmm. learnings others have.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So this was not really a competitive environment.
You compete against yourself.
You compete against yourself.
I saw one website of another county, mm-hmm. social services, mm-hmm. and they have a one-line motto. And I've always thought, you know what? I say that among ourselves, but I don't say it. That's not like our mm-hmm. official motto, but it should be. It's to be the best.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I feel. We mm-hmm. want to be the best.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So because in entrepreneurial literature, there's a lot of collaboration, but there's also a lot of competitiveness. But here, it's kind of like, it's collaborative competitiveness to be the best you can be. And it seems like you're saying that you borrow from each other and you share.
Absolutely.
Quite a bit. Oh, very, very, very interesting. Great.
I mean, there's no, mm-hmm. This is not, there's no profit motivation here.
Right.
So,
right.
Mm-hmm. You do things because you believe, mm-hmm. you believe in what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Even as I say, to be the best, well, what does that mean? I mean, mm-hmm. That can just be a throwaway phrase. How do you, as Joe Mariano, our budget director, very correctly states, if you don't measure it, you're mm-hmm. not going to achieve it. Mm-hmm. So you got to make some of this stuff concrete.
Mm-hmm.
And again, when I sit down with the directors, we talk about, what are we trying to accomplish?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. it's not just complying with the regulations. Mm-hmm. Anybody can do that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
what really do taxpayers pay us to do in our community? If we're mm-hmm. talking in child welfare or Medicaid or energy assistance or temporary assistance, mm-hmm. what is our core mission?
Mm-hmm.
What do people expect of us? Both from a social policy perspective, from an efficiency perspective, and then you try to start developing standards that you're going to measure yourself by. And again, I'm not big on developing, a static strategic plan, kind of like the communist 5-year plan. Mm-hmm. It's much more mm-hmm. fluid than that.
Mm-hmm.
You got to have a sense of mission. You got to have a sense of how to operationalize that mission.
Mm-hmm.
You got to measure yourself against that. And honestly, this isn't just a public relations document.
Mm-hmm.
You got to honestly assess whether you're achieving it or not.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not, is it because there are things that are utterly outside of your control?
Mm-hmm.
Is it because you just haven't been able to figure out and you need just to, put your shoulder to the wheel more?
Mm-hmm.
Are there other things that happen that mm-hmm. you say, hey, I need to, again, I'm not beholden to any static plan.
Mm-hmm.
Something might happen where you say, there's this problem, mm-hmm. there's this opportunity,
mm-hmm.
I have a new idea.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
That's the fun part of the job.
Yeah, it sounds exciting.
It really
which
is
I
fun.
Think I hope the students, one of the big issues is, students who take human services case management and take social welfare and want to go into the human services, we haven't been teaching entrepreneurial skills in the sense that they're needed in this environment. And what you're providing is a lot of insight into what types of skill bases are important, what kinds of sort of attitudes toward what you're doing. So that's very, very helpful. Biggest challenge with this project? Did you have a big challenge that would be helpful that sort of could be a thing
for the welfare one?
Yeah, for the case study, before we move on to anything else you want to talk about. As far as sort of the case study, something that students should ponder, what was a big sort of, how are we going to handle this to make the project go forward?
Honestly, it was everything.
Everything, uh-huh, uh-huh.
There were, it's easy to say we're going to make work the centerpiece of the system.
Mm-hmm.
But, and it was, County Executive Piro and the legislature and the executive's office were unbelievably supportive. But then, the practical issue of how do you redirect this huge mm-hmm. enterprise mm-hmm. that has for decades mm-hmm. been going in this direction?
Mm-hmm.
And so, everything had to change.
Mm-hmm.
Not only, the structure had to change, operations had to change, the, you know, what the worker on the line, what the clerk who's supporting the worker on the line, what they're doing has to change. You know, you need to develop information systems that support what you're doing. So it was just, you know, it's like, you know, President Kennedy saying, we're going to go to the moon.
Yeah.
What does that mean? You know,
uh-huh.
you don't just do it. It's just a zillion things need to change. The culture of the staff was an issue. Because, again, I remember having one of the staff said, my job is to get these cases off my desk. I was sitting back saying, oh, yikes, this is going to be tough. You know, and that was a very realistic appraisal of how he saw his life and all the pressure points. So how do you address that? Because it doesn't do any good just to say, well, okay, do that, but focus on this. What does that mean?
And in previous reforms, I mean, this wasn't the first attempt at getting welfare, work involved, right? Wasn't the Family Support Act of, I don't even remember.
96.
Before that. Before the personal responsibility work opportunity. This is actually probably before you were actually in this area. There was something, was it late 80s? Maybe 89, there was a Family Support Act that started that encouraged work but didn't require it or something like that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But it didn't really mean anything.
Well, this is different. See, that seemed like a top-down approach, whereas this, you were doing this before 1996. When did you actually start? When did this 94, Jobs Plus...
94.
94 Jobs Plus started.
Yes.
And then did you have to actually change what you were doing when the actual 96 and then state 97...
Not really.
Stuff
no,
came
we were,
through.
No, we were really well positioned.
So you just all these things about performance. What are the performance measures that you, the federal, like on the federal website, they have all the participation rates and things like that. You were already keeping track of those things, and so it's almost like this program predicted what was going to happen.
It'd be nice to say that, but no. But
how were you so aligned?
We did what we were operating within the regulations. We did what made sense. We did what made sense.
And there were other counties across the country that were doing similar things and probably were well positioned as well.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And they're all sort of synchronized, kind of, to what the federal legislation was. So there was a lot of their communication, what the federal government was thinking and what the state was thinking.
Boy, that, you know, I can't remember that far back. I'm sure we started getting, you know, wind of the changes, you know, sometime during this process, and, you know, started thinking about what it might mean. But then, you know, even after the legislation, then, you know, then the feds have to develop the regulations, and then it comes down to New York State, and the state has to develop legislation to comply with the feds, and then develop regulations. So it's a real time-consuming process. So, you know, in the void, we just keep going and do what we do.
This is a weird thought's coming to mind. I just wanted to, it almost seems like if you know how sometimes a job has a temporary employee, and they want to have a new hire, and so they say, oh, but we can't just hire this person. We have to search, right? So they say, we're going to make a job description that really pretty much fits what this person does, right, or the qualities they have, and then we'll hire for that position. And, of course, that person's a top priority. It almost seems like that's what the federal and state governments were doing. Well, this is what our counties are doing. This is what our states are doing, so let's write the legislation. Is it like that? Is that a bizarre idea to you? You know, they saw what was happening. What I'm trying to grapple with, how could you be doing your own local thing before the legislation happens, and then the legislation ends up basically saying, keep doing what you're doing?
You know, what we changed was kind of the engagement piece. I mean, the federal legislation changed a lot of things. It changed the time limit. You know, that was a huge change.
Not something you were doing anyway.
No. Mm-hmm. No, that stuff was, I didn't see that coming. You know, the time limit, the block grant.
You didn't see the block grant either?
No, you know, you know, we were just, our focus in the welfare to work was just the engagement piece.
Mm-hmm.
They changed the rules of engagement. You know, back, you know, when I started in social services in the late 80s, a parent was exempt from participating in work until the child hit age 6.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometime in probably the late 80s, early 90s, it moved to age 3. With this legislation, the personal responsibility legislation, it was 1 year. So, you know, huge change mm-hmm. in kind of the expectation, the engagement piece.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we started, we were still working with, you know, age 3.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So when the legislation changed, it changed the, it increased the population we were going to work with. It didn't mm-hmm. really change the expectations.
So just tweaked what
yeah.
you had to do. So you just have to change age a little bit.
It's just common sense.
Keep track of a timeline, a yeah. time limit. The block grant, did that change how you funded this? Did you just replace a block grant? I'm not exactly sure how that even works.
That's really a state issue. The block
yeah.
grant goes to the state.
Mm-hmm.
The state continued the funding mechanism that it had always operated on.
Okay, so is that still like it was a 30, 60, 90? No, that's a triangle, right? It was like 50,
yep.
25, 25?
Yep.
Something like that?
Yep, same thing.
It still does that?
Yep.
So it's in state, still 50, 25, 25. But I read somewhere that causes pressure. If you don't cut caseloads, then when the federal funding goes out, it shifts to 50-50 state and county, something like that.
When someone exceeds their 5 years
mm-hmm.
Or you know loses eligibility for federal cash
mm-hmm.
assistance,
mm-hmm.
in New York State, that case transfers to the safety net program.
Safety, and that is
50-50.
Okay. Does that provide budgetary pressure here?
Sure.
You just have to make sure people don't exceed the five-year limit?
You know, it's not a huge number.
Yeah, so it's not a big issue. Because, well, you hear about the pressure with the federal legislation gave pressure to cut caseloads. Have you heard that in the news? Or at least that's a measure of success federally, right? I don't know if that has anything to do with what we're talking about, but
the pressure is to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, cutting case... I mean, cutting a caseload... Unfortunately, you know, the information systems aren't terrific. And that really isn't a criticism so much because, you know, after someone leaves, you know, they're done with us. You know,
mm-hmm.
or they may be done with us.
Mm-hmm.
They don't necessarily want to continue a relationship with us. They don't need to.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Makes perfect sense. So it's hard to say what is happening to everyone who's leaving the system. You know, some very, you know, mm-hmm. small federal studies have tried
mm-hmm.
to do that,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
you know, to ask that question. But kind of in the absence of information on the big picture, like
uh-huh.
what is happening to families who are uh-huh. leaving welfare,
uh-huh.
the focus tends to be on how do we know we're succeeding?
Mm-hmm.
Caseload.
Mm-hmm.
So if the caseload's going, it's kind of a shortcut.
Right.
But that's part of the answer.
Yeah, I mean, every social science indicator is incomplete, right? It's
yeah.
just one aspect
yeah.
of a,
right.
Yeah, you're trying to measure one aspect of an elephant.
Yes,
yeah.
yes,
mm-hmm.
yes.
Mm-hmm.
But that's mm-hmm. not the only thing. You know, one measure that we mm-hmm. look at, and mm-hmm. we pay a lot of attention to it, is the percent of cases that have access to food stamps and Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, cutting the caseload, you can set up administrative hurdles and make it hard for people to comply.
Mm-hmm.
And that's nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
You don't do that. That's just not right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, great.
So, you know, we want to, you know, assure ourselves that we're doing what we can so that people who are leaving
mm-hmm.
really are leaving better.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. I don't want to take up all the time. I want to have some chance to talk about MuniMinder briefly.
Sure.
Does that sound good? Is there anything else you wanted to say about this?
No.
I think this would be a very interesting case. You know, about, I think especially what you talked about earlier about not feeling like the direction was going in the right way of the ship and really using this together, we'll make a nice case study for the I'm gonna probably maybe send it to you if you want. Hopefully,
sure.
Correct anything, you know, edits or anything like that. And then
administration's not rocket science.
No, but it is a skill. It is. I think it is a skill. It's what is rocket science anyway? Well, anyway, we can.
Very technical.
Yes. Yes.
You know, I always thought I could never be an Einstein.
Mm-hmm.
Or a Newton, because mm-hmm. that genius is so technical.
Mm-hmm.
The genius that I can really understand is like a Charles Darwin,
mm-hmm.
who just observed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was a naturalist,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
and he observed. He read,
mm-hmm.
and he thought, and he paid attention.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what we do. I mean, mm-hmm. we're paid to see the whole board,
mm-hmm.
and you keep on asking the questions. I mean, you know, and I think if administration has any skill set, you know, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just asking the questions and developing the relationships with others to get the information, to develop solutions, workable solutions,
mm-hmm.
to address either the policy or the operational issues
mm-hmm.
that we have concerns about.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Great. Great.
So we don't really need any skills.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, there.
I can't be a teacher.
What?
I can't be a professor like you.
It's pretty much it's the same kind of a thing. That, you know, a lot of.
You gotta be curious.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that, you're curious. It's actually, I think it's very similar.